Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Body Bags with Joseph Scott Morgan. Being a New Orleans native, one of the things that I put a lot of stock in is fine food. You go a lot of places and, you know, you measure that location by the cuisine they serve. I've been around a lot of chefs over the course of my life. The story I want to tell you today has to do with a man that spent nearly 50 years not just working in the kitchen as a chef, but teaching others not just how to cook, but things like foraging for mushrooms, how to set a kitchen up, how to make a living with your hands, following those things that you really, really love. Today, I want to talk about the murder of Dan Brophy. Jackie Howard's with me, the executive producer of Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. Jackie, what do we have relative to Dan Brophy and his life?
Dan Brophy was a beloved chef and instructor. His students spoke highly of him. He worked for the Oregon Culinary Institute in Southwest Portland. He had been there since 2006. Students came into the school early one morning and found Daniel Brophy dead, shot in the kitchen, did not appear to be any forced entry. The assumption was made that it was a robbery or attempted robbery, but it took some time for police to come up with the idea of what they think actually happened. Daniel Brophy was married to a romance novelist, Nancy Crampton Brophy. One of the stories that she was credited with writing is called How to Murder Your Husband and also The Wrong Husband. Police began their investigation in the kitchen. How do you start? Because you have a location where many people come in and out, and we all know you cordon off the scene and start there. But when you have something that does not appear to be a forced entry, Dan Brophy still had his wallet, his cell phones, and his car keys with him. What are the things that we're looking for?
Dan's practice, according to, you know, all of his colleagues, was to leave the house early in the morning. He'd head out for the culinary school and, you know, sometimes arrive around 5:30. You imagine that. And you know, one of the reasons, you know, I'm a college professor. It's, you know, I don't have to show up to do that sort of thing. This guy's a hands-on instructor. He has to make sure that everything is squared away in the kitchen. You know, that all of the foodstuffs are laid out correctly, that they have all of the utensils that they're going to need that day for the instruction that's going to be ongoing. And it's a class set up, so it's labor intensive. It's remarkable what these guys go through. Very intense learning in this environment. So, you know, when we think about that initial theme of 5:30 in the morning, you have to begin to think that if it didn't happen outside the building, which you would, you know, think that if somebody's walking from their vehicle to the entrance, that there would be maybe an effort on the part of the victim initially to fight with the person if they're being held at gunpoint, you know, that they know that they're going to be killed or something like that. There's no evidence of that. And then there's no evidence that the lock was jimmied on the door. And here's another part to this is that one of the things that Dan would do, you know, in my opening, I talked about how he was a forager. Not only was he a forager, he was considered by some a master gardener. I don't even know what goes into that sort of thing, but he would grow herbs. And one of the things that we do know about these folks that teach in these culinary environments, you don't get paid a lot of money. So they would have side gigs that they would do. And one of the things that Dan would do is he would have a collection of homegrown herbs, and he would kind of bind these things together, I guess things like oregano and sage and all these sorts of things. And he would sell fresh herbs, and he would put them on a cart. It's like a hand cart. You see teachers using them lots of times. And, you know, that cart was actually in the hallway. He had all of his herbs set up out there and even had his keys, you know, resting on this cart, which gives you an indication that he was going about his normal process. So there's no evidence that someone walked in and kind of strong-armed him, you know, where they're throwing a gun up in his face and he's doing things that are outside of the norm. So as an investigator, when you show up in this environment, you have to begin to factor these things around. And sometimes the stuff doesn't come to light until afterwards. You know, the cops have no way of knowing when they show up at the scene that his normal activity was to get this card out, put the herbs on it. Maybe he rested his keys there. Normally that comes after the fact, after you begin to interview people. So, you know, immediately you're thinking, well, was this somebody that actually knew him that perpetrated this horrible crime?
As the police start to interview students who showed up for class that day, one of the things that police uncovered is the fact that the door was still locked. We talked about no forced entry, Joan. Right here is the classic telltale sign. The door was still locked. It was Dan Brophy's routine, as you're talking about, to unlock the door for the students as he prepared for the morning. So as they began to show up for class that morning on June 2nd, they knew something was wrong. The students waited for a long time, but it wasn't until another instructor let the classmates in that they found Brophy's body. They say he was lying on the floor by the sink, the water was running, and the lights were on. Students began to try to do CPR. They made the call to 911. So what does all this tell us, Joe, with the fact that the door was still locked? How did the perpetrator get away?
This goes to, you know, I use that word, you know, kind of normal, if you will. And that's a theme that you'll hear me talk about. I don't care if people get tired of hearing it or not. That's something that everyone will hear from me. And that's what makes death investigation so unique and also so horrible is the fact that I'm not talking about us as investigators. I'm talking about people going about their normal day-to-day business where they are always having to see the abnormal in the context of the normal. You know, for them, for those students that walked in and found their instructor, you know, this person that they sat at his feet to learn from, you know, laying in this position, can you imagine everything that was going through their mind? They're trying to save their instructor's life at this point. They're doing chest compressions and everything, and he was gone by this time. So whoever had perpetrated this crime had done it in such a manner that there were no signs of life left in his body at that moment in time because he wasn't transported from the scene. They worked the scene. And that's kind of a big tell for us in investigations. That means that when EMS might arrive, they know that there is no hope. So what does that imply? That implies that there is a specific marker in time that has gone out. That means no signs of even agonal respirations. There, you might even have changes after death. At that point, the body is growing cool to the touch. But the question, I think, is how did this individual leave the premises without anybody being aware? How did the door kind of lock behind them, you know, as they were exiting? Is there some way to manipulate that lock? And here's another big part to this. How would they have known to have locked that door unless they had intimate knowledge of not just Dan's activities, but the environment itself?
One of the students who found Dan Brophy began doing CPR, and she said that his chest felt squishy. Her words, squishy. She thought she had broken his ribs. Now, ultimately, we know that he was shot. So what would be the explanation for that feeling, Joe, squishy?
It can arise from a couple of different places. First off, you have the squishiness. If folks at home will just imagine a fluid-soaked sponge, if you've ever held a fluid-soaked sponge, whether it's a bath sponge or, you know, one that you keep on the sink when you're washing dishes. You know the consistency of that. It's wet. And when you compress it, it has kind of a squishiness to it. And that would mean that the area was potentially very hemorrhagic. We know that these injuries that Dan sustained went in to his chest. That's very well documented. And when that happens, you have something that occurs that's referred to as pleural effusion, which means if you have major organs, and it doesn't even necessarily have to be a major organ, you can just clip a vessel. And guess what happens at that point in time? That open space around the lungs just begins to fill with blood. And there's nowhere for it to go. Remember, it's no longer in the vessels. You're bleeding out into this open space. So when she's doing compressions like this, there could be a squishy feeling. And even from bullet defects, you can have blood. If you can you imagine this being a student and you're doing chest compressions through the defects, you've got blood that's kind of, it's almost like a font that's coming up and spraying blood, not spraying in the sense of arterial spray. It's not that dynamic, but the area outside of the body is becoming super saturated with every compression that you do. Now, another explanation for this is that if in fact these rounds were to pass through any of the bony structures, when you begin to think about the sternum, which is the large flat bone that's right in the center of our chest, or the ribs to either side, those are going to become fractured as well, just by the impact of these rounds. That'll have kind of a good way to describe it is a squishiness to it too, because all of that area, as long as he is still living for a moment or two, becomes super infused with hemorrhage around that area. Those little areas under the skin are becoming hemorrhagic. So that'll lend itself to that as well. So it's a bloody mess in the literal sense of that term. I feel so sorry for the student that had to endure this, because it was absolutely a horror show.
Guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
We talk about this a lot in death investigation, particularly where homicide is involved. You begin to think about, you know, who could have been angry enough, agitated enough, in order to bring an end to somebody's life. And contrary to what you see in even popular media or in fictionalized novels, it's generally not some stranger in a dark alley. It's going to be those individuals that are in our immediate circle. And in this case, Dan Brophy's wife, Nancy, was arrested.
Yes, she was. In fact, she quickly became the only suspect in this murder. Police found evidence leading back to Nancy Brophy. And in fact, the first thing which was a strike against her was the title of her novel, How to Murder Your Husband. I would have to imagine, doing what you do for a living, and me as well, being a journalist, one of the things that we both do is ask questions. When you throw a writer in with a forensics person, that can be a dangerous combination.
You're absolutely right about that. I'm going to confess something here. I'm going to confess one of my greatest fears. You don't find people doing this very often because it shows you being weak, but I'm going to confess one of my greatest fears. I've been involved in forensics and death investigation since I was a very young man, since I was essentially 20, 21 years old. It was the first time I ever walked in a morgue. And people are always curious. They're always curious. They always want to know, because people are generally not around death. And for me, you know, I inhabited the world of death for years and years trying to figure out what happened. And there are any number of times I've been called to speak in public. And of course, I do it on air a lot. And I would go to these writers' meetings. They would ask me to come in and speak, you know, to crime writers, wannabe, you know, fictional crime writers and that sort of thing. And there's always that little thing in the back of my mind, where I'm speaking to this crowd, and they haven't been vetted. And generally they're there, you know, for their purposes. They want to know about forensics and kind of how it all works and this sort of thing. But there was always that little thing in the back of my mind is, who exactly am I educating on this audience? Are these people here to try to learn about the mechanics of forensics and certainly the science of it and how they can create this beautiful narrative where they create some kind of mystery? Or do they want something else from me? Do they want to try to figure out how to get away with a perfect crime? So in answer to your question, yeah, it's something that has always kind of sat in the back of my mind and made me quite fearful many times. You know, you kind of walk out of the room after you've talked to him, you say, maybe I shouldn't have said that. But to that point, I have no evidence yet to indicate that I've been in any way implicated in any kind of homicide out there yet.
Well, Nancy Brophy's self-published romance, How to Murder Your Husband, essentially ended up not being admitted into trial. The judge ruled that it would be excluded, but there was lots of other evidence. There was a timeline that didn't seem to add up of where Nancy Brophy said she was to the surveillance video, Joe, of traffic cameras that showed Nancy Brophy's minivan in the streets around the Institute close to the time of the shooting. But she says she was nowhere near the Institute. So how did police go about putting all of these things together to come up with a timeline of how she could have done it?
Yeah, you know, in this case, they lived obviously some distance away from the institution. And, you know, there's always already one vehicle that's there, and that's Dan's vehicle that he had shown up early in the morning, you know, to begin work. And you've got a very tight window here. You'd have to have intimate knowledge of the comings and goings, not only of Dan, but guess what other population? The students and then Dan's colleagues that are showing up to work. So when they saw her van, you know, kind of circling in this area, when they went back and reviewed the CCTV information, it did not marry up with the times that she claimed she was not there. I mean, you know, you've got a physical image of her driving about, moving around at shortly after Dan had come into the location, began to set up for the day. And, you know, we kind of talked about that. But, you know, there were these other issues that had come up. She claimed that, I think, that she had still remained in bed when Dan had left the house. She had an awareness that he had left, apparently. But she contends that she was, you know, in bed writing. That's, you know, we've already talked about how she was a writer. And then there was the issue of feeding the chickens. They kept chickens on their property there, which is another kind of little aside relative to Dan and the world that he inhabited. Dan, I didn't even know this kind of thing existed. I guess I should have. But Dan was regarded as a master poultry preparer. And one of the things about that is you have to know how to slaughter chickens. And so they actually had chickens on property there that would be obviously to furnish eggs, but also to provide meat so that you could do dishes with these sorts of things. So all of that did not marry up with the police. And you have a suspect that is telling you something that does not marry up with what the police are sitting there, and I can see them all sitting around a monitor before they ever approach her about this. And they're establishing a timeline that's marrying up because, you know, every one of these CCTV cameras, as it's being recorded, it's documenting that time over and over again, second by second. We're working in linear time. And if you go back and you begin to question a suspect in this particular case, you know that it is an empirical impossibility for her to have been in two places at one time. In this case, she apparently was riding around, scoping out the area, measuring the area for who may or may not be there. Was Dan there by herself? And it's that moment in time she apparently chose to strike.
Another very important piece of evidence that came into play here was money. Money always seems to be a top motivator from what we've seen covering cases for a very long time now. And what we find out is that Nancy Crampton Brophy had taken out life insurance policies on her husband's name. Now, in general, that's not, you know, most wives and husbands have insurance policies on each other. But we find out that she took out 10 different life insurance policies in her husband's name that would give her, at his death, more than $1 million. So what we find out is that Nancy Brophy was in money trouble.
So many times we find out these cases are rooted in financial gain. And, you know, as a financial investigator, if you bring somebody into the case that does forensic accounting, for instance, and has a real feel for numbers, particularly in the world of insurance and those sorts of things, they can run a balance sheet, essentially. And that's kind of an oversimplistic way of putting this. But you have to understand, you know, how much is your life actually valued at, and your properties. You know, one of the reasons that you have an insurance policy is, you know, you want to make sure that your loved ones are taken care of. But if you have, like, for instance, outstanding debts, particularly the biggest one in our life is generally our mortgage, do you have sufficient amount of funds to cover that? You know, say one lump sum that's given to you and you can cover it. But this far exceeded what their balance sheet as a couple belied. It was, you know, this is so far over the top that you have to begin to understand that she's attempting to pay off debt. And the sad part about it is that because she put together these insurance policies, and I think you had mentioned that there were upwards of 10 that she had taken off, that's a huge red flag for investigators. Now, like you said, it doesn't necessarily make you guilty of homicide, but it is a circumstantial element. And a lot of this case is circumstantial, as we'll get to. It's a circumstantial element that goes in to put together this entire piece that we're looking about the life that they lived. And that's what this is all about. When you begin to think, you know, we talk about the forensics of it relative to the gunshot wounds and the condition of the scene, but what are those factors leading up to it? What's the motivation behind ending Dan's life?
So we've laid out an investigation here. We have a timeline that doesn't match. We have a computer forensics timeline. We have money difficulties. And then we come down to the last piece of circumstantial evidence, and that is a gun.
One of the biggest elements that comes about in a homicide is, I would imagine, for the perpetrators, they have to decide how they're going to go about it. And I'm not talking about timing. I'm not talking about are they going to be able to have access to their target. I'm talking about how are they going to go about it. How are they going to bring about the end of somebody's life? What tool are they going to use? And we cover a lot of things here. We talk about blunt force injuries. We talk about sharp force injuries. We talk about poisoning sometimes, but in this case, there was a very unique weapon that was involved in this case. The Glock 17 and the Glock 19 and a ghost gun.
Lots of things to uncover there, Joe, but we're going to start back with the computer. In that Nancy Crampton Brophy researched guns online, and then she purchased a gun at a gun show. Now, her attorneys explained that Brophy was working on a book about a woman who basically got revenge on an abusive partner by killing him with a gun assembled from pieces bought online. And in order to make her story believable, Nancy Brophy had to be able to do this and understand how to do this to make her story credible. First off, Joe, how do you do that? Why do you do that? And then we'll get into a ghost gun.
You know, one of the things that we look for in forensics are what we refer to as ballistic signatures. And that is, and if our listeners would just, you know, think about those things that make us unique. It's a principle in forensics that we refer to as individualization. And this goes to the implements that are used in perpetration of a homicide. You know, we begin to think about fingerprints. We begin to think about pattern injuries that come about as being struck with some kind of blunt force object like a hammer. In this case, we're talking about firearms. This ballistic fingerprint that comes down the line, every barrel, if you will, every firing pin, every extractor on a weapon leaves behind a definitive signature on either an expended casing, which is in a semi-automatic weapon. It's that soft metal casing that is ejected out of the port that's left behind by the extractor marks. And of course, as the projectile is traveling down the barrel, it kind of expands out in the barrel because of the heat and the explosion that takes place, that little miniature explosion, and it expands out into what are referred to as the lands and grooves, which are the spiraling features inside of the barrel that are actually manufactured in there. And it, the spiraling creates stability in the projectile. It also maintains power. You know, years ago you had muskets that weren't rifled. Rifling these lands and grooves maintain that energy, so you have much more power upon delivery as it exits. But the trade-off with this is that those spirals in there are unique to individual weapons. And I'll give you an example. If we have a weapon that comes from manufacturer A, and it's say a 9mm, and they make say 300 weapons in a run, guess what? Each ballistic signature of that 300, even though they're manufactured at the same time, is going to be unique to that weapon. And much more so after those weapons make their way out into the hands of individuals that purchase them, that signature becomes more unique. And it's dependent upon how well you take care of the weapon, if you clean it, what type of ammunition you're pushing through it. And also just day-to-day bumping around, and that can impact the ballistic signature that's left behind. So every weapon is unique, and that's one of the things that we look for when we recover projectiles from bodies, or say that are embedded, say that have passed through a body and they embed themselves into walls or floors. We go in there and carefully extract those projectiles so that we can look at the impressions that are left along the shaft of this projectile, and test fire it through the suspected weapon and see if those lands and grooves match up. Now, there's one more piece that I didn't talk about here. Something else that is unique to a weapon is the firing pin impression. And that is, it almost looks like a nail if you think about a firing pin and you're talking about the tip of it as the weapon is charged essentially in order to fire, you know, kind of cocked, if you will. The weapon is cocked and that firing pin slams forward. On the base of every one of these bullets, intact ammunition, there is what's called a primer cap that's at the base. It's right in the center. It looks like a bullseye. And microscopically, did you know that you can actually marry up the tip of a firing pin to the strike point in the center of that primer cap? And it is unique to that firing pin. So you've got several points along the way where you can match these things up.
But is that still possible, given the fact that Nancy Brophy bought multiple interchangeable parts for this gun?
Well, that's the problem. If you buy, in this case, there was a Glock, which is a particular manufacturer, and people hear about it in the media all the time and in entertainment, you know. You hear about a Glock weapon, which is an Austrian-made weapon. She had a Glock 17, and she had a Glock 19. Now, they're both 9mm weapons, which is the type of ammunition that she used. And so the interesting thing about these two weapons is that you can, even though they're different models, the 17 is actually longer than the 19, you can actually use parts from the 17 and the 19 and kind of vice versa on a limited basis. However, if you go out independently after having purchased these two factory made weapons, you get into this weird world that's referred to as the ghost gun environment. And, you know, for folks that don't understand what a ghost gun is, this is an aftermarket adaptation that you can go out and purchase Some people refer to them as homemade guns, but they're available out there. They've been available for years and years. And let me kind of tell you how this works. If you think about a semi-automatic weapon, such as in the Glock 17, it has a slide on top of it. And you may have seen this in movies where people will charge the weapon by pulling the slide back and then it slams forward. Well, when you pull that slide back, what you're doing is in a very simplistic way. I'll just use this because the Glock doesn't have a hammer, like an external hammer. You're essentially cocking that weapon. Now, what happens is if you buy a ghost gun, and in this case, we're talking about a barrel and a slide, you take the manufactured barrel and slide off of the weapon. Okay, you put it aside. And you take your ghost gun, which fits the same frame, and you slide it on top. And remember how I talked about earlier that these barrels create unique signatures, okay? Unique signatures that are unique to those particular barrels. Well, when you pump around through that thing, you take the slide off of it, you take the barrel off of it, which are the ghost gun, if you will, and you put the factory made slide and barrel back on it, no one's going to be any the wiser. You take the ghost gun parts, and I don't know, I've been to Portland. Portland's right by the Pacific Ocean. You take that thing and you throw it out there as far as you can, because at this point, when the ballistic examination was done on both the 17 and the 19, they couldn't tie it back to either one of those barrels. And this all comes down to digital forensics, because the police believe that Nancy went on eBay, of all places, and purchased a ghost gun.
So this brings us back to that firing pin that you were talking about just a moment ago, Joe. They were not able to match that strike.
Yeah, they're not. And this is what's, and I can only imagine for a firearms examiner, some people refer to them as ballistic scientist and firearms examination. I can only imagine their frustration because they've got two casings. Remember, Dan was shot twice. His injuries were essentially in the chest, okay, and in the back. And here's a little something that people might not know that don't deal in the world of anatomy the way I do. We have both an anterior chest and a posterior chest. Physicians, when they're doing an examination or autopsy, they generally don't say back. They'll say posterior chest because they all kind of communicate with one another. So for our purposes here, we'll say he was shot in the anterior and posterior chest. He had two rounds that entered his body. They actually recovered the spent casings. And can you imagine the frustration that when they get there, and they recover these casings, the police are probably thinking, oh, wow, we've recovered the casings. The perpetrator, the person that perpetrated this crime, didn't stay around long enough to collect them, and then they ride off into the sunset. No, they left them behind. That's a big piece of evidence, and it's something that when you're an investigator and you're working on unsolved homicide, that's one box you can tick automatically, say, oh, my gosh, we've got recovered casings at the scene. That means that if we can get our hands on a suspected weapon, we can pair that up because we're looking at extraction marks, which when that slide goes back in the process of firing, there's these extractors that pull these rounds out or pull the spent casing out, and it ejects it. And they leave these little striations on the side of the casing. And striations is just a fancy term for little linear marks that are on there, but they are unique to a particular weapon. Okay. That is extractors contained within that slide. They also couldn't match up the firing pin in this case, again, contained within this slide. And when you look at the base of that bullet right there on that primer cap and you look at it microscopically, for people that are not familiar with microscopes and, you know, when you do comparison microscopes in the ballistic lab, you begin to look down, the ocular, viewer, and you can see down the long axis and you're looking at that dented primer cap, and it has features like the moon that are unique. that are unique to that particular event. And can you imagine they're test firing it with similar ammunition and they're not generating the same thing every time. So their frustration is really high. So at the close, all they could do is put this together circumstantially. Now, the interesting thing about a Glock weapon is that out of all the other weapons that are out there, Glocks are unique. And particularly from years back, depending upon what generation of Glock you bought, they're the first weapon. A lot of people don't know this. They're the first weapon that is actually formed out of a plastic mold, and they're made with polymers, which makes them very, very light. Their characteristics are unique. So when you're looking at general classification as a ballistic scientist and you're examining this thing, you can generally categorize the extraction marks. You can generally categorize the rifling marks that are left behind on the projectile and even the firing pin marks and say, okay, I might not know which Glock this came from, but I do know it came from a Glock as opposed to a Smith & Wesson or a Ruger or an HK or a Sig Sauer or whatever you're looking at. I know that this came from a Glock, but they just couldn't match it up to a specific one.
How technically apt do you need to be able to assemble these gun parts to make a working gun? We know that Nancy Brophy bought ghost gun parts online, and then she also bought a slide and barrel to fit the Glock that she already had. So how much knowledge do you need to be able to make this a working gun?
I'll sum this up by making this one statement. Do you have a computer and do you have access to YouTube? That's how simple it is. And with about a 15-minute tutorial, you can learn how to break down their whole categories within YouTube that teach you how to clean a Glock weapon. Any number of the platforms that are out there that Glock has created, you can go and put in that particular type of Glock. And part of cleaning a weapon is you have to break the weapon down, okay? So within about 15 minutes, you can change it in and out. And I'm sure that, you know, when she's planning this thing, she's, you know, she's saying Eureka. You know, because she bought this ghost gun, if you will, and she already has these two other platforms. And she looks at this thing and she says, okay, well, everything's riding on this. You know, all her quote-unquote research is riding on this. She's watched a YouTube video. She sat there. She disassembles the manufacturer-made weapon, grabs those ghost elements, plops it on there, charges the weapon, and she looks at it, and she can dry fire it. And she knows right then that her task is accomplished. And all it takes now is for, and I don't know that she did this, but all it would take now is for her to go to a firing range or somewhere out in the wilderness and pop off a few rounds to get comfortable with this thing, just to make sure that it works, just so that she has maybe a fail safe in place. Because I don't know if she may have shown up with a backup weapon. Remember, she had two Glocks. But it's very easy to do. It's not like she has to be even a gunsmith in order to do this. I think that anybody that has access to the internet could make this happen very, very easily. And I got to tell you, it's a unique approach on her part to alibi herself by saying that this was part of research. Because again, back to what I said earlier about being fearful who's out in the audience, it terrifies me.
The slide and barrel that Nancy Brophy bought online were never recovered. So that basically means that there's no way to make an identical match of the weapon that killed Dan Brophy.
Right you are about that. And I would think that if her case were to come up if her case were ever to come up on appeal, one of the major points of appeal could potentially be the circumstantial nature of the ballistics with this, because there was no way that they could put that weapon into her hand, firing that weapon and generating those unique markings on those projectiles that brought Dan's life to an end. I think that for me, that could be a major point of contention on the part of her defense team if they choose to move forward with an appeal in her particular case. I think that would make it unique. I'm Joseph Scott Morgan, and this is Body Bags.
The lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.